Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on the program today, COVID crossroads. New COVID predictions show younger people will cause a spike. Is the second wave here?
National daily case count has been increasing at an accelerated rate.
Okay, we can hear Bartosz, but could we try to make the image bigger?
The feds released new COVID modeling today as cases rise at an alarming rate across the country. Who's driving the surge? And will Canada actually be ready? In moments, we bring in the minister responsible for Canada's vaccine procurement plan. Is there any hope coming? Then, the speech from the throne is tomorrow, so why is virtual voting still such a mess? Students
and youth is to exercise their right and their privilege to vote.
6 months into the pandemic, why did Parliament only test virtual voting yesterday? Will they be ready? And why do MPs have special access to a private clinic for COVID-19 test? Well, the public shivers in hours-long lineups. Should Conservative leader Erin O'Toole have used that private clinic? We'll bring in MPs to debate that. And a massive deal for Ford Motor Company today, but who is giving them the money?
We were determined to ensure that we solidified a product for our Oakville plant. I think it's fair to say today that as an organization, we hit a home run.
Nearly $2 billion will be invested in two plants in Ontario for electric vehicle manufacturing. But are the federal government and the province footing the bill? Unifor National President, the man you just saw there, Jerry Dias, will join us on the program. And Prime Minister Trudeau will speak to the country on the national networks tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. Eastern after the speech from the throne. What will his message be? Press Gallery will dig into that and much more. It's Power Play. Let's get to the players. Well, a spike in cases, but not in deaths. This is the headline coming today after the federal government released new COVID-19 modeling data today for the first time since August. Right now, Canada has 146,410 cases, but according to the current trajectory, Canada could hit between 150 to 155,000 cases by October the 2nd. Most people will be under the age of 40, if protocols are not strictly followed, that is. Dr. Tam, the chief medical officer, says Canada is at a crossroads that could also result in a high end of approximately 9,300 deaths by the same time frame. Currently, Canada has seen 9,232 deaths from COVID-19. So what is the defense plan? Well, today, the federal government inked another deal with pharmaceutical firm Sanofi and GlaxoSmithKline to obtain 72 million doses of its protein-based COVID-19 vaccine candidate. It's still just a candidate. That means in total, Canada will buy at least 154 million doses of a potential COVID-19 vaccine from five different companies. And they've allocated $1 billion to pre-purchase these candidates. What happens if none of them work? Is there any guarantee on the product or a return on the money invested if the candidates are all a bust? Spearheading the effort is the procurement minister, Anita Anand. She joins us now from Oakville. Minister, always good to have you on the program, and I hope you and your loved ones are doing well. When can we expect to see these vaccines roll out? What's the earliest possible date?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Evan. Great to see you. We have five contracts in place at the current time, and I want to stress how uncertain yet innovative the international environment is in terms of the development of vaccines. We have these contracts looking at delivery dates for early 2021, but I want to stress that Health Canada regulatory approval is necessary, as well as ensuring that these vaccine candidates go through phase three clinical trials, which are, as you know, randomized samples of about 30,000 participants.
Yeah, I just want people to understand that. There's usually three phases of the trial. The last phase, as you say, is the big trial. Then you're talking about 2021. So let's say one of these five works. And again, it's a gamble, and I appreciate we've got to get in the queue or we won't get anything. Then there's got to be health approval. Then you've got to scale it up and distribute it. So let's say someone's looking now and say, when can I get one of these things if I'm not a frontline worker? What would the earliest possible date in the best case scenario be?
Well, Evan, I appreciate the request for precision and specificity on this point, but I have to push back a little bit and to reiterate the importance of understanding the complexity and uncertainty of the environment relating to vaccine development. There is a rush to get a vaccine in place, to be sure, but at the same time, we need to make sure that vaccines are safe and effective prior to being used by Canadians. And that's an important point to remember when we are speaking about the question of when will I be able to have a vaccine. Having said all of that, my role as Minister of Public Services and Procurement is to make sure that we have agreements in place with vaccine suppliers on the recommendations of the Vaccine Task Force and the Public Health Agency of Canada. And that's exactly what I'm doing. We are aggressively negotiating delivery dates for early 2021. We are making sure that we are well placed in terms of those agreements to ensure that there are manufacturing facilities for these vaccines in multiple jurisdictions so that we are not dependent on any one country or any one manufacturer to get access to these vaccines.
Listen, I appreciate what you're talking about, the complexity. We don't know if any of these are going to work. They've got to pass trials. I completely understand how complex it is. And by the way, how much faster this is going than any vaccine probably that's ever been developed. So I appreciate all that. The bottom line, though, Minister, is almost everybody's, this is it. I mean, this is the big play. Everybody's looking at this. Businesses are needing a vaccine. So I know it's difficult to ask, but we're trying to manage people's expectations. This will, you know, if we don't get a vaccine, we might still have to spend billions of dollars supporting businesses. People will die from this horrible pandemic. So if they're available in 2021 in the best case scenario, to scale it up and to make them available, is it 6 months? Is it the middle of next year, as they're saying in the United States? The president saying it's earlier. Just what's on the government's line to be able to scale this and distribute a vaccine if one is able to be found?
So I appreciate the question. Just let me assure you that I don't think we should be looking at the vaccine as the silver bullet alone. What Dr. Theresa Tam and the Public Health Agency have continued to reiterate is that there are multiple prongs of our approach to fighting COVID-19 as a pandemic. We need to make sure we're social distancing, wearing masks, and ensuring that we are following public health advice. We need to invest in vaccines, as we are doing. And we also need to pay attention to therapeutics. I also announced a contract today for remdesivir, a therapeutic drug that has received Health Canada approval. So, Evan, it's really a multi-pronged approach to addressing COVID-19. And in terms of the manufacturing of a vaccine, which was also within your question, we have to remember that there are some companies that have begun manufacturing even as they are waiting for phase three clinical trials to be completed so that they are able to complete their deliveries as negotiated in our contracts.
Right. I mean, obviously, I'm pressing for a date because you got anti-vaxxers out there. There's lots of frustration, and this is going to be critical. Just before I let you go, Minister, the Prime Minister has just announced he's going to speak at 6:30 Eastern time tomorrow on the main network. We'll be covering it here on CTV, of course. But can you give us any indication why, after the speech in the throne is going to be read, why does the Prime Minister requesting national airtime? What's he want to talk about?
I heard this today also, that the Prime Minister wishes to address the nation. And I'm actually not surprised, given that throughout this pandemic, each and every day, our Prime Minister, especially at the beginning, was out speaking directly to Canadians. Because during this time of crisis, Canadians need to hear from their Prime Minister. And they appreciated very much hearing from him in terms of their questions and their comments and their feedback.
But to be fair, Minister, to be fair, you guys prorogued Parliament. We haven't heard from him because you prorogued Parliament. I'm just trying to figure out, Parliament's back tomorrow. That's the forum for the Prime Minister to speak and answer questions from the opposition. You've also got the speech from the throne. Any indication why he's requesting major network time at 6:30 p.m. Eastern right after the speech? Is there a special announcement, or is it just, I need to talk to the nation again?
Listen, Evan, I'm not privy to the Prime Minister's remarks for tomorrow night, but I will say that he has been speaking to Canadians throughout the past few weeks and months,
right.
And he will continue to do that throughout the next weeks and months. Why? Because that's what Canadians expect of their leader, and I'm sure that he will focus on what our government needs to do in order to continue to support Canadians the way we have throughout this pandemic, from my part in terms of PPE and vaccines, and from a broader governmental standpoint in terms of economic supports for businesses and Canadians alike.
Minister, I got to leave it there. I always appreciate having you on the program. Thanks. Big announcements today. I appreciate your time. Thanks, Minister.
Thanks, Evan. Take care.
All right. You take care as well. A reminder that the Prime Minister, as we just spoke about, will address the country tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern. We will bring you the address in a special report. It will be anchored by CTV News chief anchor and senior editor Lisa LaFlamme. Again, that's 6:30 p.m. tomorrow on CTV and CTV News Channel. I'll join Lisa on that as well. Meantime, the Canadian suspect arrested for sending a ricin-laced letter to the White House appeared before a Buffalo court this afternoon. Let's bring in CTV's Annie Bergeron Oliver. She's been following the story with the latest. Annie, what is she being charged with?
Well, right now she's being charged with one count of uttering threats against a U.S. president. Now, this is something that comes with a maximum jail time of 5 years. What's interesting here, Evan, is that not too long ago I spoke to a former FBI investigator who said it's likely more serious charges will be laid against her, potentially around the ricin, the creation of it, and the fact that that was mailed across a border. It's just that the FBI needs more time to gather up that evidence. So right now, one charge that has a maximum of 5 years imprisonment.
You obtained some documents on the case. What does CTV News learn from that?
Yeah, so that's right. So the court documents contain an affidavit in which the FBI detail what was allegedly in that letter that Ferrier sent to the U.S. president. And in that letter, according to the FBI, she calls the president an ugly tyrant clown. That's a quote. She also puts threats in the letter, according to the FBI. I can read them for you. It says, I made a special gift for you to make a decision. This gift is in the letter. Goes on to say, if it doesn't work, I'll find a better recipe for another poison, or I might use my gun when I'm able to come. The other interesting thing in this affidavit, the FBI says that six other letters, very similar ones, were sent to different places in Texas. Four of them had fingerprints that matched hers. She was arrested back in March 2019 in Texas, so her fingerprints were already in an FBI database. And one more interesting thing, even though I know I'm running out of time, U.S. Border just came out with a statement to me. They say that on Sunday, she approached the border, she stopped her vehicle, officers got out. The U.S. Border goes on to say she actually self-identified, gave them her name, said, I am Pascal Ferrier. The U.S. Border says that she then says she was wanted by the FBI in connection to these ricin letters. And that's when border agents said they searched her car, found that she had ammunition, a gun, as well as a knife, Evan.
Wow. Why she admitted it, I don't know. That's fascinating. We'll find out. Her lawyers had very little to say today outside the courtroom, but CTV Annie Bergeron Oliver had all the details. That's a weird confession to make at the border. Annie, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks,
all right,
Evan.
Coming up next, voting woes.
We're
last
still talking an hour and a half
virtual
after
voting.
The vote. So that tells you a lot about the difficulties that were encountered. I'm hoping that we can find a resolution to it, but, you know, a vote shouldn't take an hour.
Last night's test of virtual voting took an hour. The usual vote takes 8 minutes. What's going on? MPs will debate the pandemic parliament next. Well, it's the 11th hour before Mr. Trudeau's throne speech, and the House of Commons still doesn't have a firm agreement on how MPs will be able to vote on it. Sources have told CTV News that a virtual vote test last night took much longer than expected, like an hour instead of 8 minutes, had multiple hiccups. Meanwhile, two federal political party leaders have been diagnosed positive with COVID-19, meaning they will not be there in person to hear the speech from the throne. One of those leaders, the Conservative leader, Mr. O'Toole, got his positive test after getting tested at a special private clinic that was just set up for parliamentarians, not available to the average Canadian, who are facing overwhelming wait times just to get a test. Should he have used the private clinic? We should also mention Mr. O'Toole's wife, Rebecca, has just tested positive today. We wish her and her husband and, of course, Mr. Legault good health very soon. But to talk about all this, MPs are with us. Joining us, a Conservative MP and health critic, Michelle Rempel-Garner. She's in Ottawa. NDP whip, Rachel Blaney. She also joins us. And Liberal MP, Adam Van Cuverden, is also here. Great to have all of you here. I'll start with you, Mr. Van Cuverden. Why is the government just testing virtual voting now? You guys have had all month to do it.
Well, it was the same system that we've been using to meet virtually for the past couple of months, Evan. So I can't speak for PROC and why we're only just testing the system now. But, you know, people keep saying that voting only usually takes 8 minutes. That only leaves 1.4 seconds per vote, which I've never experienced. Granted, I'm a new MP, but it doesn't usually go that fast. And quite frankly, I'm happy to spend an hour to vote if that's what it takes. It was to iron out kinks yesterday, and doing it on Zoom will work fine. Canada's been extremely innovative and agile throughout this crisis. Lots of people have had to make changes to their schedules and, you know, working from home. And it's incumbent upon MPs to do the same thing. So I think we need to be a little bit flexible. We need to work together to ensure that we can all vote and make sure that it works for all Canadians, because the two leaders of federal parties can't go to the House of Commons. So we've got to make accommodations and ensure that everybody can vote.
I get it, but we are in the 11th hour. Michelle Rempel, the Conservatives oppose virtual voting. Now the House is scrambling to make it work. Do you think it was the wrong call first to oppose it, or what do you think the glitches were?
Well, the reality is it does only take 8 minutes to do a vote. I know that some of my colleagues, like the one that just spoke on this panel, might not have had that experience because his party leader has shuttered Parliament for the better part of the year. I'm just glad that Parliament is going to resume and that I can exercise my democratic right on behalf of my constituents again. I have confidence that the Speaker can iron these kinks out. I want to vote. I want to see the estimates. I want to see the budget. The function of Parliament has to resume. And I'm going to go into this optimistic. We've got to make it work because Parliament can't stay this way. And what I don't want is the Liberals to say it didn't work last night, so we're shuttering Parliament again. I would rather say, let's make it work. We're smart people, and let's get back to business.
Okay, so now, Rachel Blaney, now the Conservatives are saying they want to make a virtual voting work. Okay, that seems like people are coming together on this. Rachel Blaney, what do you make of it?
Well, let's certainly hope so. You know, the reality is the NDP were the ones that wrote a letter to the Speaker to say, based on the report from PROC, and I am a member of PROC, what's happening with the testing? And we were told nothing was happening. So we started to talk to all of the parties to get things moving, because exactly, I couldn't agree more. We need to do our parliamentary function. It's absolutely essential, but we have to do it differently. We have to do it virtually, and in some people in the House, some people not, so that hybrid model, and we need to figure out the voting. So I'm, you know, it was unfortunate yesterday. It didn't work out very well, but I would also say that in other legislatures in Canada where they've practiced this, the first time was rough. So let's keep doing it. It's too bad the Liberals waited so long to get it started, but I don't want to see the Conservatives throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Okay, let me just switch real quick. Michelle Rempel, I'm going to come back to you. The leader of your party, Mr. O'Toole, has tested positive for COVID-19, as is his wife. We wish them good health. But he was first turned away from the public testing center. The long lineups there have been absolutely brutal. Then he availed himself of the private parliamentary testing clinic, essentially jumping the public line. Now, this was set, I hadn't heard about it. It was set up last week. What is that the message that MPs are getting, special access to testing while the rest of Canadians have to wait in long lines? Why did he use the private clinic?
No, I first of all, he did wait a long time. And I think that experience, I know I had a call with him afterwards. It really impacted the statement that we put out this week saying that, you know, the federal government has a responsibility to look at alternative methods so that somebody who can't afford to take 6 hours off of work isn't making the choice between work and not getting a COVID test. So I think that was, you know, a positive thing. The reality is I'm sure the case was with Mr. Blanchet from the Bloc. Our party leaders have meetings with people. They are at many different events. You've got to make sure that that knowledge is there as soon as possible. So, you know, I think this is frankly the NDP and the Liberals trying to make hay out of the situation. Obviously, we support a strong publicly funded healthcare system, one that is equal for all. But right now, it's not working, right? I mean, again, there shouldn't be 6 hour lineups.
But I mean, is there any hypocrisy there to say you support a public healthcare system and then the leader decides it's so bad, I'm going to just take the private one. Now, I know, by the way, it's available to all parliamentarians, but...
You know what? Mr. O'Toole would have been criticized if he didn't get his results by the NDP or the Liberals. He would have been criticized one way or the other. The minute that he got this done, he put out a statement the next morning and he said, where is the federal government on rapid tests and home testing, right? And that was the responsible thing to do. It was a responsible thing to do to get results, right, come out and have a solution moving forward that all Canadians can benefit from within the context of a publicly funded healthcare system.
Rachel Blair, you have said that you don't support the creation of this. By the way, the Conservatives didn't create it. It was created by Parliament. But what will you let NDP folks, MPs, use this private testing clinic? And do you think Mr. O'Toole sent the right message?
Well, you know, I am from the party of Tommy Douglas, so we absolutely need a healthy and robust public health care system. And that is something that both under Liberal and Conservative governments has been cut, the federal transfer to the provinces and territories. So I think step one, if it's not good enough for Aaron O'Toole, we might as well see more investment from the federal government to make it right for everyone else. I've asked my members not to use this, and I believe that they will listen because this is who we are. And it's unfortunate that this is how this crisis is being identified. You know, we need to get the resources out there so that everyone can get a test, so that we can be safe. We need to look at all of those processes that will help keep people safe. And part of that is also having a strong virtual parliament.
Adam Vancouver, do you think it's fair that MPs get special access to a testing site?
Well, that wasn't a decision made by politicians. That was one made by the House. And I don't begrudge Mr. O'Toole or his wife for availing themselves of the most convenient test. I just wish him, his wife, and Monsieur Blanchet the very best in their recovery. Look, Health Canada, that's Canadian doctors and researchers with expertise and degrees. Not politicians are making these decisions. And they've recommended against antigen-based and antibody-detecting rapid diagnostic tests for clinical decision-making. And I'm glad that in Canada we have that expertise to rely on, because if they're not reliable immunodiagnostic tests, then I don't think that we should be encouraging Canadians to take those.
Yeah. You guys aren't going to approve
that. Respectfully, Mr. Vancouver, the question was, parliamentarians are getting a private clinic to get testing faster than the rest of Canadians, and you're saying you don't begrudge that? Like, just to quote Mr. Mulroney to John Turner at one point, you MPs have an option, sir.
Mm-hmm. They do, yes. And I am an MP that has remained in my riding here in Milton throughout the pandemic. So, frankly, I didn't even know about the testing center. It's not something that I would choose to use. But I'm just saying, I don't begrudge Mr. O'Toole for using the test that it was available for him, that was determined by the House to be a necessity. He just ran a leadership campaign where, by necessity, he had to be in touch with, you know, lots of people throughout that period of time. I'm sure there was some inadvertent handshakes. It's difficult not to shake hands sometimes. But with respect to this Safe Restart Agreement, the federal government has dedicated $11 billion just for health to the provinces. And we've been working with the provinces for the last 6 months to increase the availability of testing, to increase the reliability of testing. And we're pursuing, other immunodiagnostic tests that'll take less time. But the fact is, as politicians, we have an obligation to Canadians to ensure that we're using the best information and asking researchers and doctors to make the best recommendations for those decisions, because as a politician, I have a science degree, but I don't want to be making those decisions. Right. And I think when politicians do stick their necks out there and say, hey, we should be using these tests that I read about on Twitter, I find that incredibly irresponsible.
Okay. We're just saying you're
okay,
slow.
Guys, unfortunately, I'm losing Michelle Rempel-Garner there. Sorry. But guys, I'm going to run into a break. We're going to have this conversation again. I know this is a very critical debate. Michelle Rempel-Garner, Rachel Blaney, Adam Vancouver, great to have the three of you on us. I really appreciate that. Boy, these Zoom calls can be a little tricky. I appreciate that. And a reminder, we will have special coverage from the Speech from the Throne beginning tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. Eastern right here on CTV News Channel. Before we go to break, some other news you need to know. The battle over Ottawa's decision to impose a federal carbon tax is heading for a final showdown. 2 days of arguments before the Supreme Court will decide whether the Liberals' climate plan is actually constitutional. In separate cases, Alberta, Ontario, and Saskatchewan say the plan encroaches on areas of provincial jurisdiction. The carbon pricing system is a critical part, of course, of the federal government's plan to cut carbon emissions 30% below 2005 levels by 2030. And the government of Ontario is revealing its fall COVID-19 preparedness plan over time. It's a slow rollout. The first pillar includes a $70 million investment in the largest flu shot campaign in Canada's history. So far, 5.1 million doses have been secured. The premier is urging Ontarians to make sure they get the flu shot soon. And on Ottawa health officials, this is quite something, are announcing new self-isolation measures to crack down on the spread of COVID-19. Check this out.
Any person that tests positive for COVID-19 has signs and symptoms of COVID-19, is a close contact of someone who's tested positive for COVID-19, has been tested for COVID-19 and is awaiting a test result, or otherwise has reasonable grounds to believe they have COVID-19, they must self-isolate without delay.
All right, that's Vera Etchez, the public health officer in the capital of Ontario. All right, coming up, $2 billion. But where is the money actually coming from?
Up until today, of the $300 billion announced, not one nickel has been allocated to Canada. But with today's announcement...
A massive deal with Ford Motor Company, but will the taxpayer foot the bill? Unifor National President Jerry Dias joins us next. Stay with us. So the Ford Motor Company has agreed to an almost $2 billion investment in two Ontario plants to build electric vehicles. After striking a deal with Unifor late last night, Jerry Dias, the president of Unifor, announced the tentative deal today. The union workers at Ford will vote on the deal this weekend. But who's actually putting the money in? Is it Ford or is it the federal and provincial governments? To find out more, the man who was up late last night negotiating the deal, Jerry Dias, joins us from Toronto. Mr. Dias, first of all, you must be very pleased with this. I can see that. But can you tell us who is actually investing this $2 billion in these two plants? Is it Ford Motor Company or is it the federal and provincial governments?
Well, the lion's share of the money is coming from Ford Motor Company. Are the federal and provincial governments going to pony up some money? The answer is absolutely yes, but Ford is definitely one chinning the bill.
Okay, but Ontario Premier Doug Ford said today the province will be kicking in, he said, quote, a massive amount to businesses like Ford for battery manufacturing. And then we've heard that there might be up to $500 million immediately for this, and then up to $2 billion from the federal and provincial government. Are those numbers right?
Not that I'm aware of. Is the federal government already announced that they're going to play? The answer is yes. The provincial government, are they going to play? The answer is yes. To what extent, I'm not sure. But it's pretty straightforward, Evan, and here's why people are clamoring to get auto investments. My members pay $2.7 billion a year in taxes. The companies pay a heck of a lot more than that. So even if they pay $270 million for the purpose of the discussion, you know, you're going to get 10 times back your payment in 1 year. And if it's a 10-year project, do the math. It's simple. If I give you $10, if you give me $10 and I give you back $100 a year for 10 years, you're ponying up to 10 bucks pretty quick.
So it's the return on investment argument. Do taxpayers get any return? I mean, I understand that return on investment, but is there an upside? And you talked about this before. For example, will the public get any deal if the vehicles are profitable, any share of the upside, any stocks in this? Or is it just, we'll invest, we hope it's successful, and we hope we get the money back in taxes?
You're going to get the money back in taxes. I mean, the auto industry is a $100 billion a year industry. $80 billion of that is exported. So the return on the investment is huge. This employs thousands of people. If you take a look at the direct and indirect jobs in the province of Ontario, it's about 500,000. So the question you have to ask yourself is somehow, as a province, are we better off without 500,000 jobs? The answer, of course, is no. But ultimately, just based on our taxes alone, we build a lot of roads, build a lot of bridges, build a lot of schools and hospitals. So it really is a huge return on your investment. And that's why governments around the world are candidly rushing to invest to get those types of investments in their countries.
Yeah, although a lot of citizens are saying, gosh, Ford Motor Company made $6.5 billion in profits last year. This was before COVID. Why are the taxpayer having to pony up money? But I understand there's a war for these jobs, and if they're not here, they're somewhere else. But what does this say about negotiation with other auto companies and the future of electric vehicles in Canada, sir?
Well, I'm not sure that we're heading down the electric road today with Fiat Chrysler, for example. They made a $2.6 billion investment in Windsor in 2015 for the Pacifica. We have the Voyageur. We're looking for a couple of extra vehicles in order to bring back the third shift. Same thing with the Brampton facilities. We have some highly successful vehicles being built. So we're looking to complement that you know, that portfolio. But is it going to be the future? And the answer is yes. If you take a look at today's market, Evan, about 3% of the global market is electric vehicles. By the year 2040, it's going to be 50%. So you better start getting into the dance today, because the Ford announcement will not only create some stability in Oakville for the long term, but it also forces auto parts suppliers to invest. It forces them to relocate. So Canada's positioned quite well based on our recent negotiations and what the governments are saying.
All right. Well, we'll find out how the union members vote on the weekend. Jerry Dias from Unifor, major negotiation completed. I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure's mine, Evan. Thank you.
All right, coming up next, Canada at the COVID crossroads.
It seems to me like a surgical approach at this point in the stage of the pandemic is an appropriate one.
Is Canada ready for a second wave? Is investing $1 billion in unproven vaccines really the best answer? The press gallery weighs in. Our infectious disease specialist, Dr. Abdushal Kawi, will join us. Stay right here with Power Play. Canada is at a crossroads. Those were the words from Canada's Chief Public Health Officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, during a press conference today, sharing the latest modeling data for the COVID-19 pandemic. Data showing that in the short term, Canada's epidemic is set to keep growing, especially with people under the age of 40. Dr. Tam said that unless we readopt some of the health precautions, we could take off into a second wave. We could see over 150,000 cases, over 9,000 deaths by October the 2nd. What needs to be done? Is it time to burst our social bubbles or restrict them even more? Let's bring in the journalist from Ottawa, the Globe and Mail's Bob Fyfe. He's the bureau chief here in Ottawa. Great to have you back, former host of CTV Question Period. In Montreal, Le Devoir's Emily Nicolas. And our expert voice today is from Toronto, Dr. Abdushal Kawi, CTV's infectious disease specialist. Great to have all of you here. Dr. Sharkawi, I'll start with you. What was your main takeaway from the figures today about the pandemic projections?
Well, I think they're conservative, quite frankly. I think that this has been creeping up on us for some time, and I would not be surprised to see numbers even higher than what Dr. Tam is projecting. We have to remember that the younger demographic was more or less abiding by public health guidelines and restrictions back in March and April. Things have opened up, socializing has been renewed, and you've got a mass of susceptible people out there that are now going to become infected and going to potentially spread this to others, including older segments of the population. So I'm very troubled by the trend that I'm witnessing right now.
Yeah, and Bob, from a political point of view, every time we see this stuff, we got the speech from the throne tomorrow, obviously, but provincial governments, municipal governments, the federal, they got to start looking at more restrictions. Can the economy, is there any stomach for more lockdowns, as it were, Bob?
Well, we may not have any choice, Evan. We're heading into the flu season, and this is going to be a terrible blow to both the health of Canadians, but also the economy. One has to sympathize with the premiers and the prime minister who are worried about the economy and the hit it's going to take. At the same time, we can't afford to have a lot of people put in hospitals and end up dying. So the government the message has to be very clear. And I think we're going to hear from the prime minister. We're hearing it from the premiers. People, smarten up, social distance, wear masks. Don't be irresponsible. That's the message that's going to have to be delivered by all segments of the population.
Yeah, I wonder if that's part of his message when he speaks at 6:30 Eastern tomorrow night. Emily, Quebec's top public health official, says you guys may be in the second wave. What does that mean in terms of how it's being handled in that province?
I mean, he said actually that we were definitely in a second wave, and that's very much real. I think the goal is to make people very much understand that this is not a game anymore. And there's no, you know, summer kind of, there's none of that. This is very serious. And so, yes, there will likely actually be, there's already been some tightening up of the rules in the last couple of days. But at the same time, it's not just about the government, you know, making those rules. It's also about the population really understanding that this is serious and people not waiting to get a ticket or have the police come to their house to actually respect the rules. And there's been some issues with that over the summer, and now is not a time to play anymore, for sure.
Dr. Shirkawi, I just spoke to the Minister of Procurement, Anita Anand. They spent $1 billion trying to get, you know, five different companies trying to get a vaccine. It was very hard to get an answer from her about when this could be available. She's talking about 2021. What's your take on how they're going about getting a vaccine? And in the medical community, when could we possibly see a scaled up distribution of this?
Well, the answer to the first part of the question is things are moving along at an unprecedented pace. So it is potentially conceivable that before the end of 2020, you may get close to a vaccine that has gone through some degree of reasonable phase three testing to make sure that it is safe. The problem is once you get into 2021 and you have something that's deemed acceptable, we're in line behind a lot of developing countries that are in a much greater need than we are when it comes to vaccination. So we're going to have to stand behind in that queue. And then beyond that, you're looking at healthcare workers, you're looking at people living in long-term care facilities and the most vulnerable segments of the community being vaccinated first. So that may not be until sometime in the spring of 2021. If you're talking about the masses being vaccinated, more realistically, you're looking at end of spring or early summer of 2021. So it's not just around the corner. We've got a lot of work to do for risk mitigation in other areas before we depend on a vaccine.
Boy, Bob, those timelines, you know, you're talking about the speech from the throne and budgets. What do you make of the vaccine timelines, the scaling up, the distribution of all that, and the long impact on that, Bob?
Well, I think that the medical advice is that do not expect to get a vaccine for the majority of Canadians or majority of people in around the world until the summer of 2020. And the government is doing what it can to make sure that it can get a number of vaccines, because there will be no sympathy for any government that is slow in getting the vaccine to people, especially if they see people in other countries, other developed countries like the United States or Great Britain, with the vaccine, they can't get it. So the government is doing everything in its that it possibly can to make sure that we get the vaccines that are needed. But you and I probably will not be vaccinated until the summer or September of next year, just because we're not in that high risk group.
Yeah, and just real quick, Emily, they're putting a lot of chips on the table on these vaccines. But again, I think people have to realize we got to manage expectations. It's a long cycle here, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we need to really focus on the measures that are in place in terms of social distancing. I also saw the Premier Doug Ford is looking into actually the flu vaccine and making sure that it reaches as much as the population as possible during this winter. Because one of the reasons we're afraid of a second wave during the winter is because hospitals are already taken with the flu. So if we get more vaccination on that, perhaps it will help as well.
All right, guys, I got to take a break. Dr. Shirkawi, I really appreciate you joining us, as always, with your insight. A little depressing, to be honest, how long this is going to take, but we got to just be very, very patient. We're going to take a break. Emily and Bob are going to stick around. But coming up tomorrow, the big day, the Governor General, Judy Payette, will read the throne speech. Maybe she'll add something. We don't know. Is the government ready to handle the ongoing COVID challenges? All that and lots more. And why is the Prime Minister speaking at 6:30 Eastern tomorrow? We dig into all that next. Well, this is going to be good. A speech from the throne like no other. Justin Trudeau will address the nation after the Governor General, Julie Payette, reads tomorrow's speech from the throne, which is kind of weird. We haven't seen that before. Are we in for a parliamentary session bogged down by all sorts of details of virtual voting tests that didn't go well? Are they going to work that out? Is the government ready for the throne speech? Will there be an election? And should Aaron O'Toole have used a private testing clinic after he couldn't get a test at the public one. The press gallery is here to discuss. Bob Fife from The Globe is back. Emily Nicolas from Le Devoir is back. Lisa Raitt, CTV News political analyst. She is our guest on this round. Great to have you here, Lisa. Just real quick, 24 hours from the speech from the throne, we still don't have details of how to vote. And now the prime minister is going to speak at 6:30. What do you make of all this?
Well, clearly he wants to own the news cycle, but I would ask you guys, Evan, whether or not you plan on giving opposition equal time, because there's an election going on in two ridings in this country. So it's extraordinary that he's doing this. I question whether or not he's thought that through.
Bob Fife, I haven't seen a request. I mean, we got this request. I'm sure all the media did. Justin Trudeau wants to speak to the nation at 6:30. I don't know why. This Parliament's back. What do you make of all this, Bob?
Well, look, this government's all about PR and messaging. The throne speech is at 2 o'clock. Very few people will be watching it. And it's read by the Governor General. This is an opportunity for the Prime Minister to get to speak to everybody at 6:30. You know, everybody's at home in that time at supper hour. So he's going to have an opportunity to talk about COVID and to talk about the key themes in the throne speech. It's great political messaging for him. To answer your question, though, I know the broadcasters are going to offer an opportunity for the leader of the opposition to respond. Obviously, it wouldn't be as long as the prime minister, but apparently he is going to have that opportunity, which is the right thing to do because we are in a pre-election period.
Yeah, 100%. We got to have fairness. Emily, it's fascinating. First of all, there's lots of expectations of this. One little side note here is the tension possibly between the Governor General, Julie Payette, who's basically under investigation under allegations of workplace harassment and others, and the Prime Minister. What are you looking for tomorrow?
I think the throne speech, I wish we knew what we were looking for. There's a lot of things is up in the air. But in terms of the address to the nation, I think it's interesting that because it's a minority government, there's been a lot of stuff thrown out in the air about a potential election, all of that. It sounds like a political game, but at the same time, if we stop and think a little bit with the second wave that is popping up, COVID, it would actually, if it was a majority government with no talk of election, it would still actually be a good time to have an address to the nation if really the message is to be about COVID-19 and how the second wave is upon us and how we need to really crack down on, social distancing and making sure that we follow the rules. So that would be a good move, regardless of the politics.
Let me just quickly switch over. Erin O'Toole, the leader of the Conservative Party, reportedly used a private clinic. I think the Globe first reported Marika Walsh that makes testing available through the House of Commons. Now, he had gone to a public clinic, Lisa Raitt. The lineups there are ridiculous, that they're out of control. So then he decided to avail himself of this thing that was created internally at Parliament, as I understand, last week. Is that the right message to Canadians at this moment? Hey, you're waiting in a massive line, but I'm really busy, so I'm going to just take the MP's private clinic.
You know, it's really tough. You got to put yourself in the position and the shoes of the individual who made the decision. You got to wonder why the House of Commons decided that they could set up this easy access for members of Parliament. Clearly that the administration, clearly the parties decided this was the way to go, because the House of Commons makes decisions based upon what the party leaders want to do and what the House leaders want to do. So they made the decision. All MPs were part of the decision. I didn't hear anyone complaining about it prior to Mr. O'Toole taking advantage of it. So they're all going to have to wear it equally.
Yeah, the NDP says they're not going to use it, Bob Fife. What do you make of the message that this sends to Canadians, that MPs have decided, or the Parliament's decided, here, we're going to get our own little clinic?
Look, I think it's a very bad message that it's sending to Canadians. There's one rule for you and another for politicians. Politicians are always against a two-tier medical system, except when it's going to benefit them. And so they go to a private clinic. It's a bad thing for all the parties to be involved on, and a good thing for the NDP to stand up and say, we are not going to be part of that.
Emily, it would have been quite remarkable. Imagine if Erin O'Toole, he's trying to introduce himself to Canadians, had said, I have an option. I could do this. Parliament said that, but I won't do it. I'm going to stand with you. He didn't say that. Now, maybe, obviously, his wife has tested positive now. He's positive. Maybe an anxious time, but, he is the leader of the official opposition. We're into a potential pre-election cycle. What message does it send?
It sent a message that actually when MPs want to get something done versus e.g. a China clinic for themselves, they can, but that there are other issues with this pandemic that is harder actually to get through. So it's definitely not a good look. Here in Quebec, we have, you know, frontline workers that are still, you know, waiting in queue. There's definitely a lot of parents who are worried with having their kids at home because they're just sniffing, but they cannot take them back to school until there's a test, and that takes forever to come. So it's when those parents watch the news, I'm not sure they're very impressed.
All right, guys, unfortunately, I got to leave it there. We got a long day tomorrow, special coverage of the speech from the throne. Bob, Lisa, and Emily, always great to have the three of you on the program. And remember, we'll be here at 1:30 Eastern to begin our special coverage of the speech from the throne. That we have a great team there. I'll be part of that as well. And then Lisa LaFlamme, our chief anchor, will, of course, be hosting at 6:30 that special delivery of the Prime Minister. What is he going to say at 6:30 Eastern? We'll talk lots about that, and we'll be back here in 23 short hours for more Power Play. If it's safe, hug your loved ones, have a great evening, and thanks for joining us.